The next matter on for oral argument today is McTavish v. Lifetime Fitness. Council, as you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing is indicated in the clock and the lighting system in the podium. Yellow means you've got 5 minutes left. Red means your time's expired. You can raise or lower the lectern. There's a button in front to match your height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the benefit of the public record that we're making only the audio record. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. I am Hugh McTavish, Minnesota attorney number 0312010, representing myself in this lawsuit. May it please the court, the facts of the case are these. I was a longstanding member of Lifetime Fitness in good standing. In 2022, I was the candidate for governor of Minnesota of the Independence Alliance Party, the party that elected Jesse Ventura. The day before the election, I distributed campaign flyers at Normandale Community College, placing them under the windshield wipers of the cars parked in the parking lot at Normandale, with no complaints from anybody there. At the end of the day, I had some flyers left over, and I went to Bloomington South Club of Lifetime Fitness, and I distributed about 40 flyers in the same way, again, with no complaints from anyone at the club while I was there. I had done the same thing at my home club of White Bear Lake earlier in the campaign.
If I could jump in, McTavish, you can certainly go on with the facts if you want to, but just so you're aware that we're familiar with the facts, thank you for your briefing. Both sides have presented a factual record. It might help to jump right into the legal issues, but you're free to, it's your time, you can use it however you like.
I think I have time, but I'd done the same thing at my home club of Lifetime, White Bear Lake, earlier in the campaign with no complaints from any members or staff there. The day after the election, I got a call from someone asking if I had distributed campaign literature at Lifetime in Bloomington. I said I had. She immediately said I was permanently banned from Lifetime Fitness. I asked the basis for the ban, and she gave two reasons. Both of them were lies. She said the contract had a no solicitation clause, and she considered political campaigning to be solicitation. That was a lie. The contract does not have a no solicitation clause. And second, she said there was a Bloomington ordinance that banned political campaigning on private property, and she was enforcing that ordinance and punishing me for violating it.
I was at a loss in looking at your brief and case law to see that element mattered to whether or not either Lifetime or Ms. McLagan were state actors for the purpose of your First Amendment claim. Help me to understand the basis for that.
They were state actors because she said she was enforcing an ordinance. She said she was punishing me for violating an ordinance.
And so the case law then that you're relying upon that would elevate a private actor to a state actor based upon that sort of representation, false or not, is what?
I'm relying on the plain language of the statute. The statute says 42 U.S.C. section 1983 creates a cause of action for violation of right. It's clear my rights were violated. My rights to free speech and campaigning for public office were violated.
No, my question goes to, in order to make out a constitutional claim, you have to establish that the defendant is a state actor.
That's not what the statute says. The statute says...
So what's the language in the statute? That you believe is met when an individual says, we're responding to a violation of the ordinance.
The language of the statute is, it creates a cause of action, 42 U.S.C. section 1983, for violation of right by a person under color of law. It doesn't say a person who is a state actor. It doesn't say a person who is paid by the state. It doesn't say a person who just says a person. McLagan and Lifetime are persons.
Assume the case law would indicate a state actor is necessary.
If the case law has said that, it's wrong because that's not what the statute says. But I don't think the case law said that. I don't recall that they cited any case law that it has to be a state actor.
I thought that the district court relied upon a case that required state actor status.
The district court didn't rely on any case. It didn't cite any cases.
Wicklund?
Wickland, right, Wickland.
I thought the district court specifically referenced Wickland in its decision.
Oh, yes, it referenced Wickland. Wickland is easily distinguished from the peasant case in that Wickland concerned fur protesters who were protesting the sale of fur at Macy's. They were, Macy's had them taken away for trespassing. So it stands for the proposition that a business doesn't have to allow protest against, doesn't have to allow protest against the business itself.
I was referring specifically to the state actor component to the district or to the decision in Wickland.
I don't recall that there was any discussion of the state actor component in Wickland. Well, there was discussion of whether the Mall of America is a state actor because they received money from the state, and it was held that they were not. Mall of America didn't say they were enforcing any ordinance. They just, or any statute. They just,
right, but doesn't Wickland stand for the proposition and the second basis for the decision that a state actor relationship is necessary for the constitutional claim? At least that's the way I read Wickland. You read it differently?
I think the issues, I don't recall that 42 U.S.C. section 1983 was actually cited in Wickland or claimed by the plaintiffs for that this was a violation of right under color of law.
There was a constitutional claim that was being brought, and I thought your claim was one that was being brought under section 1983. Actually, your complaint doesn't mention section 1983.
It does not mention section 1983,
apparently
right.
The district court assumed that, and the parties are assuming that, so I guess we can assume that too. Isn't a state actor relationship necessary to make a
not under the language of the statute, Your Honor. The language just says person.
Okay.
My position that they said they were state actors. She said she was enforcing an ordinance. The ordinance didn't exist. It's worse that she lied about the existence.
So that
of the
makes
ordinance.
Her a state actor.
That makes her a state actor because she said she was a state actor.
And she didn't say she was a state actor. She said,
I'm enforcing an ordinance and punishing for you. It's the equivalent, as I said in my brief, of a police officer arresting someone on the pretense that there is a statute.
It's not quite the same because a police
officer.
Could I
make the analogy?
Can I stop you before you make your analogy?
Okay.
A police officer is a state actor.
Right, I know. But the analogy would be a police officer makes a arrests somebody on a statement that there's a that there's a statute that makes it a crime to run for public office. There's no such statute. So he's liable. He's liable for that. Someone impersonating a police officer who does the same thing, or someone claiming to make a citizen's arrest on the same basis, it would be nonsensical to say that they're not liable, only the police officer is liable, that they can do what they want.
What she did wasn't to assert any penalty of law.
No, she was not asserting, she's not claiming
ordinance.
What the penalty of the law was. If the statute had existed, the penalty presumably would have been less severe than a permanent lifetime ban from socializing with your tennis friends at a Lifetime Fitness facility, as she imposed on this. She imposed a penalty for my supposed violation of an ordinance.
Okay. I think I understand your argument. The district court didn't analyze this, but I was curious as to how your complaint accuses her as well as Lifetime as breaching the contract between you and Lifetime. How is Ms. McGlagan, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, how is she liable for breach of contract if she's not a party to the contract? What's the theory that would make her liable for the breach of contract?
That she cited a contract. She cited the contract I had with her employer in terminating my membership. So she's enforcing, she said she was enforcing the contract that I had.
And the case law that would support the proposition that it can be liable for breach of contract as a non-party agent of the contracting party is what?
I have not researched that. On the facts, I would also point out that I asked for Ms. McLaughlin. It turns out to be Ms. McLaughlin who called me. I asked for her name. She refused to provide that. I asked for a copy of the contract that she said that I had violated. She refused to provide that, and that was never, despite requesting it numerous times, it was never provided until the defendants provided it in their brief for summary judgment.
It was provided, and it seems to include a provision in which the parties to the contract agreed that Lifetime had the power to make a determination when it felt that either its rules were being violated or I forgot the language.
Right. The language of the breach of contract. So I had two obligations on the membership contract: to pay my monthly dues and to present my membership card when I came to the club. It's undisputed that I complied with both those obligations. Lifetime had just one obligation under the contract, which was to allow me access to the club facilities. It's undisputed that they breached that.
But you're not picking up on Judge Rush's question. I mean, the contract seemed to say, it's written
right,
in
so
not
I was,
general terms, but Lifetime.
Well, there's a clause in the contract.
Mr. McTavish, yes. If you could let the judge finish her question before you.
I'm not looking at the contract. I'm looking at the court's order in the matter. But it talks about Lifetime may terminate membership, quote, for conduct Lifetime Fitness determines to be improper or contrary to the best interests of Lifetime.
That's right. That's the language. That is a language in the contract. That's correct.
I mean, you could argue it's very, very broad, but it seems to be a language Lifetime has included, and that seemed to be the legal basis for the.
Well, that's effectively Lifetime. The district court made an error of finding a fact in saying Lifetime determined that my conduct was improper conduct. Lifetime never said that, and they never cited this clause in the contract until this lawsuit came up. And they've never communicated to me, except in their briefs, that my conduct was improper. I would hope that we can all agree that running for public office and campaigning for public office is not improper conduct.
Well, it wasn't the fact that you were running, it was the leafleting.
Right. I would hope that that's campaigning. I would hope that distributing information about your campaign is constitutionally protected speech. I mean, if we can't do that in this country, then.
You certainly can. I mean, the issue here is whether a private entity has to allow for campaigning on premises. And it may be best for everyone that private entities like Lifetime and other places would always allow it. But as a matter of constitutional law, or as a matter of contract law, I'm not sure your brief is convincing that Lifetime has that obligation. Convince me I'm wrong.
I was trying to make the point that there is an clear error of fact by the district court when they said Lifetime had determined that I violated the term of the contract. They never determined that. The district court never determined that. The district court never said that leafleting on Lifetime parking lot is improper conduct. They've never argued it's actually improper conduct. So they're rewriting the contract to say Lifetime has the right to terminate a contract.
Are there any affidavits
at any time for any reason?
I'm going to finish my question if you could allow me. Are there any affidavits in the record that might lend support to that representation by the respondents?
Which representation, Your Honor?
That there was a determination by Lifetime that the conduct of leafleting was inconsistent with what they see as the best interest of
Lifetime. No, there's no affidavits in the record that they made that finding. If Lifetime, this is a contract of adhesion. Contract of adhesions are interpreted against the drafter. If Lifetime had wanted, they're wanting to interpret this contract that Lifetime has the right to terminate a membership at any time for any reason or no reason. If that's what they'd wanted, they should have written that into the contract. And I don't see why they would want the right term. Presumably they want to collect money from people, so I don't see why they would want to write to terminate a membership for any reason or no reason.
What makes this a contract of adhesion?
What?
What makes this a contract of adhesion?
Under Minnesota court cases I cited, a consumer contract that one party has no opportunity to modify, it's not actually negotiated between the two parties, is interpreted as a contract of adhesion, and it's interpreted against the draft.
That's the only element that's necessary to construe a contract as one of adhesion?
There may be other elements, but in this case, it seems to me it clearly is a contract.
What about the nature of what's being offered in the contract? Does that bear upon whether it's a contract of adhesion?
I'm not familiar with the law in that regard.
Can I ask one question?
Yes. Oh, yes. Please do.
I just want to be clear in my own thought. I want to step back for just a second, Mr. McTavish. I believe the record is that when you were contacted, but correct me if I'm wrong, your membership was suspended at that point. You weren't
terminated.
No, that's
not true. What? That's not true.
Okay. As I understood the record, it was suspended. You were told, for this period of time, whatever, you are not to come to a facility, and then you did continue to use the White Bear Lifetime Club in violation, allegedly, of that suspension.
Ms. McLaughlin called me and asked me if I would accept a 3-month suspension, and I said no. I'd been attending the club. She sent an email and was allowed entry into the club. She sent an email saying my membership was suspended for 3 months. I continued to go to the club once or twice after that, and then they finally refused entry. So I wasn't certain that whether she'd actually said that it was communicated to the club. They presumably have the power to check my card, and they were still letting me into the club.
Although your time expired, I do have one other question. I perhaps
sure.
should have begun with this, more of a big picture question. If I understand your briefing accurately, it seems that you're asking us to apply the standard of review that we would apply to a motion to dismiss rather than summary judgment because discovery hadn't yet occurred. Respondent argues that, what's necessary at that point is for your client, if discovery is necessary, to make a request for discovery before summary judgment, and that no request was made. Is that and I don't see a reply to that in the directly in the briefing, but if you could address that argument.
I think the appropriate standard of summary judgment before discovery is that no facts could be determined in discovery, but I don't think it really that would favor the non-moving party. I don't think it really matters in this case. I think all the facts in my deposition are the additional facts that would be discovered are not necessary to determine this legally. So I think that it doesn't really matter, but I think that what I stated in the original brief is correct on the standard of review.
Thank you, Mr. McTavish. You will have 5 additional minutes
Thank
for
you.
Rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is William Davidson. I represent the respondents Lifetime, improperly named as Lifetime Fitness, and Babbitt McLagan, is I believe how it's pronounced. We believe that the district court properly granted summary judgment and that this court should affirm both as to the dismissal of the breach of contract claim as well as the First Amendment claim that was asserted. I can address either of those issues in turn or any questions the court may have, but I'll first start off perhaps with the standard of review. We believe that this was a properly noticed motion for summary judgment and that the applicable standard of review here is for a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment. Appellant argues in their brief and here today that the Rule 12 standard for failure to state a claim, presumably, and that the court should review this as if any evidence that might be produced should be taken into account and that the question should be, has he stated a claim? And we don't believe that that's correct. As we noted below and argued below, it was a proper motion, as we've argued here. The rejoinder to that from appellant should have been a Rule 5604 affidavit setting forth the discovery that had been served or would be served, specifically identifying the nature of that evidence. And even then, the district court has some discretion. But here, no such affidavit was offered, and there's been no argument, let alone a showing that the district court abused its discretion in considering and ruling upon the summary judgment motion.
Well, looking at what's in the record, what would be the basis for us in our de novo review of the Rule 56 decision that Lifetime ever made a determination about the impropriety of the behavior that underlies the case?
If I may start first, Judge, one, I don't concede that there needs to be, quote unquote, such a determination. I believe that when you look at the member usage agreement, the one that Mr. McTavish signed back in 2007 and that the district court referenced, it's Exhibit 2 to the Nyssa Munger affidavit, and it's the language that was quoted in the order. Lifetime may terminate membership for conduct it determines to be improper or contrary to the best interests of Lifetime Fitness. The fallback, Judge, and I think the determination was made, the fact of the termination shows that they made that conclusion. To the extent the court's question is what evidence is in the record to substantiate that they made that, one, they made the determination and they terminated the membership. Two, when I think you look at the declarations.
When you say they made the determination, you mean that's implicit?
It is implicit.
There's never an explicit explanation to Mr. McTavish that we've determined that your behavior is improper and that's the reason why we're suspending you, or?
There's nothing in the record that indicates that Lifetime Fitness explicitly told Mr. McTavish, we quote unquote made a determination that your conduct was improper or contrary to Lifetime Fitness's best interests. That is true.
It seems as if Mr. McIntosh correctly recounts the facts, that he was informed of a different reason for the suspension.
And for purposes of the summary judgment motion, I think the court can and should credit his testimony as it's laid out in his affidavit. I would contend, Your Honor, to the extent there's fact disputes as to that, one is the timing of his termination, and two is the reason for the termination. I would contend, Your Honor, it's not material for purposes of this court's review. As to the timing, Mr. McTavish says, I was terminated the day after the election. I believe that's November 9th. We believe that the termination was November 25th. There was an issue as to suspension and what was the colloquy there back and forth. It's not material to the issue here, which is, was his termination of his membership a breach of contract? Was his termination a violation of First Amendment rights? The timing is irrelevant. He was terminated sometime in November of 2022. As to the reason for it, I would contend, Your Honor, that simply his characterization of why he was told he was terminated does not create a material fact dispute when you look at the language of the member usage agreement that allows Lifetime Fitness to make a determination that if it's improper in its view, or it's contrary to its interests in its view, it can terminate a membership. There is no right to be a member of Lifetime Fitness for time immemorial. There is simply no contractual right that is pointed to in the member usage agreement.
Is it not a fact question that a fact finder might say, well, you know, the real reason for the separation is not that Lifetime determined that Mr. McTavish engaged in improper behavior, but Lifetime's view that there was an ordinance that was violated, a city ordinance that was violated.
And, Your Honor, I follow the argument. I would contend that that might be an argument if we were here on a Rule 12 basis, but I don't believe that that's the would be sufficient to overturn on a summary judgment basis when the factual issue is clear, and when you look at Ms. Munger's
how is
affidavit.
That clear? I'm just trying to get a sense of how that's clear. If a fact finder said, you know, the real reason for the determination wasn't that Mr. McTavish was engaging in conduct that Lifetime thought was improper, but the real reason was that he was violating a city ordinance. Why is that not a fact issue that bears upon the breach of contract claim?
Even if it was that they concluded it was for violating a city ordinance, that's well within the language of the contract that allows Lifetime to determine the conduct is improper. If they concluded littering or making loud noises, which may or may not also be violative of a city ordinance, is improper, or in the alternative language of the contract, contrary to Lifetime's interests, they have the authority under the contract to make that determination. It's in a very similar, perhaps, to an employment at will situation. An employer can terminate an employee for any reason or no reason. They just can't do it for a bad reason. And the analogy.
Yeah, but the contract doesn't say Lifetime can terminate for no reason. It says it can terminate for conduct that Lifetime determines to be improper or contrary to the best interests of Lifetime.
Which,
it seems to be a bit narrower than for no reason at all.
Agreed, Your Honor. It is narrower. But the language of the contract that allows them to terminate for an improper or contrary to best interests reason, broad though it may be, encompasses what occurred here and encompasses explicitly what they did when you look at Ms. Munger's affidavit, paragraph 9, where she asserts that Lifetime does not permit the distribution of any flyers on its property, regardless of the message, and implicitly in what it did when it communicated to Mr. McTavish, either the day after the election, the email subsequent that's referenced, or 2 weeks, 16 days later, when his membership was terminated. They considered what he did, which there's no dispute what he did, he's admitted, he leafleted on the private property of Lifetime, putting leaflets and campaign materials on private property on the members' cars or the guests' cars.
Am I correct as a matter of fact that, and you can let me know whether it's a matter of fact or it's whether it's disputed or undisputed issue of fact, that Lifetime afforded Mr. McTavish the opportunity to come and remove the leaflets before a decision about suspension or termination of the contract?
As I read the record, Your Honor, I believe that is undisputed. I believe that that is referenced in the record, and it's undisputed that a call was made to Mr. McTavish. I believe his affidavit says that he was perhaps a half hour away from Bloomington where he had been. He references the reason why, but he declined to return. He refused, and that is undisputed. Now, Mr. Music, the gentleman who, the manager of the Bloomington facility that called, characterizes Mr. McTavish as being rude. We don't need to go out there, but to your question, it's undisputed an opportunity was given. So we don't believe that there's a breach of contract, and I'll turn briefly to the First Amendment issues. First, as an alternative basis, counsel for Mr. McTavish below, Mr. McTavish is self-represented on appeal, counsel for Mr. McTavish at the summary judgment argument admitted, quote, we don't have a leg to stand on in terms of the retaliation, close quote, if there is no breach of contract. And that can be found at the transcript 8, lines 6 through 8. So if this court concludes that the district court did not err in finding no breach of contract, I think on that basis, the First Amendment claim falls away.
When I look at the complaint, I'm not sure if that concession, maybe we hold the party to the concession of counsel, but the complaint alleges that by immediately canceling plaintiff's membership in retaliation for exercising his rights to protected speech, defendants infringed on his clearly established fundamental constitutional rights under the First Amendment. I didn't understand the correlation that was being made in the district court tying the two claims to each other. This seems to be independent of it. Correct me if I'm wrong logically, or are you saying that maybe I'm right logically, but once you have a concession in the district court, you're bound to that on appeal?
I think the latter, Your Honor. I think that perhaps the notion that one could have brought this claim on a Rule 12 standard, that's why we were talking about it, just for a First Amendment violation without pointing to the breach of contract. I think logically, you're correct that that could be an independent claim. But here, undisputed, the concession was made by counsel. Now, that's an alternative argument. I think what the district court did here in citing State versus Wicklund, a case that does require state action. The court can certainly review it, but the latter half of that opinion talks about, makes it very clear, that to have and support a constitutional violation claim, there has to be state action. In other words, and the case law is clear, there have to be state actors. Now, implicitly, a Section 1983 claim has been pled, but at its fundamental base, Lifetime and Ms. McClagan are not state actors here.
Am I correct that there was never an argument in the district court on the deficiency of pleadings? I mean, you've got a complaint that cites the federal rules of evidence rather than the state rules of evidence, but other than that, there's no reference to Section 1983, just a general constitutional claim. I gather there was no argument made in the district court that that's not a the First Amendment standing alone needs a legal mechanism to get you into court.
That's correct, Judge. There was no procedural argument or procedural deficiency argument made by the respondents, the defendants below. They just leapt into it, and implicitly, I believe all parties in the district court addressed it or evaluated it under well-established Section 1983 law, with at its base the right that in dispute, the pled First Amendment claim.
So besides state action, is there any a lack of state action? Is there any basis on which we could affirm the district court's summary judgment decision as to Section 1983, or is that the only basis?
I believe that the only basis is the lack of state action, as the district court ruled, and as we just discussed, the alternative argument that if there is no breach of contract, there was a concession made, that there is no First Amendment violation.
Right.
As to, I just want to briefly touch upon some of the arguments that were raised for the first time on appeal as to the First Amendment claim. Appellant makes much of MnStat 211B.20 regarding the right to distribute campaign materials. That is a statute that was not asserted below, not argued below, and we would argue under Thiel versus Stitch that argument's been waived. Separate from that, that statute is simply not applicable to this case. A clear reading of the statute makes it clear that nursing homes, apartment complexes, multi-use facilities have to allow certain folks to come on in and campaign. Malls, fitness centers, private businesses are not encompassed by 211B.20. 211B.20 also does not create a private cause of action, and had it been raised below, perhaps we would have raised the procedural deficiency of citing to or relying upon that. But more broadly, as I read appellant's brief and reply brief, appellant is asking this court for an advisory opinion in many respects under 211B.20, expanding that. He's also asking this court to ignore State versus Wicklund. He's also asking this court to basically broadly expand the rights and adopt public policy as to what is or is not a good rationale for when people are campaigning. With all respect, those arguments, to the extent 211B.20 is in play, should be addressed across the street. If the legislature deems certain conduct, campaigning conduct, to be appropriate, the public policy determination should be determined across the street as opposed to this court's role as an error-correcting court. We would ask that this court affirm and believe that the breach of contract claim that was properly dismissed and the First Amendment claim that fails for a number of reasons as we've discussed and perhaps as we've addressed in our brief should also be affirmed. Thank you.
I'd say counsel for the appellant, but the appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And if you could, just for the record, restate your name.
My name is Hugh McTavish, the appellant in this case.
Thank you.
my pen didn't work. So I wasn't able to write notes while he was talking. The State versus Wicklund, I'll just say, is easily distinguished from this, that, as I said, that concerned private property owner allowing or not allowing a protest against their own business on their own property. Stands to reason that a private property owner or business should not have to allow a protest that's intended to harm their business on their own personal property. That's not the case here. I was not intending to harm Lifetime in any way.
But is that
I'm just
the
trying to communicate with voters.
Do you read that as the basis for the Supreme Court's decision?
I read that as these facts are different.
OK. okay?
Yes, I read that as the basis of the Supreme Court's decision.
But is there anything in the analysis that would help us
to share
that conclusion?
I don't recall that there's anything in the analysis. I think it's implied in the analysis, but I don't recall. I can't quote the analysis.
Fair enough.
Counsel says this court should not make new law by extending 211B.20 in a way to public property, publicly accessible private property. It's not making new law. It's just interpreting the scope of First Amendment rights in this state and interpreting what is implied by 211B.20. Since that makes it a crime to refuse to unlock locked doors to allow candidates access to private property, it certainly stands to reason that they can't forbid candidates from accessing voters on publicly accessible private property.
There's this maximum of interpreting law that says when you have a list of certain things in a statute or in a contract or other legal standard that implies the exclusion of things not listed.
In that statute, it has to do with unlocking locked doors, because candidates cannot ordinarily reach people in apartments these days because they're usually behind security doors.
No, I meant when the statute.
I know the list, there's no reason to list a publicly accessible parking lot because you don't have to unlock locked doors to get access there. It's implied. Likewise, the mall.
Being asserted for the first time on appeal, correct?
That's right. But there's no harm to the district court efficiency of legal proceedings, I think, says to decide it now rather than decide it again, have it decided anew by the district court when this is remanded.
I thought that, the legal standard would be if we were to deem it not presented to the district court, I think our usual course would be to not consider the argument rather than to remand it for a redo.
I mean, it's a forfeited argument because the district court was not given the opportunity to speak to it.
I believe that's the rationale, is that it would be a waste of judicial resources, and I don't think that applies in this case if the appeals court considers the argument here. And there are other reasons that the case should be reversed and remanded. So it would be more efficient to decide the issue now than to bring it up. Nothing forbids us, once it's remanded, from bringing the issue up again, and it would be more efficient to decide it now. I'm not sure if I have anything else.
You have any further questions? Well, too bad your pen wasn't working. You might have been able to.
Yeah, I know there was something else I wanted to talk about.
Unfortunately, you're going to remember that right as you're pulling out of your parking space. Counsel for both of you, both sides, Mr. McTavish and Mr. Davison, thank you for your arguments today. We appreciate your briefing. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you, and have a wonderful afternoon. That is our last argument on schedule today for our oral calendar, so the court is in recess. Thank you.
All rise.